Welcome to Coaching Uncaged by Animas, the podcast that explores the art, science, and career of coaching. And now, introducing your host and interviewer, Yannick Jacob.
Welcome to the podcast. Right now, for a change, that means you tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. A quick note from me today, because we have high expectations of quality here at Coaching Uncaged. Unfortunately, for this particular episode with Yelena Pavlovic, the sound quality is maybe not quite what you'd expect. We sat down as a team and we decided that the quality of the conversation was so worth it that we wanted to make it available to you instead of re-recording it. Also, Yelena is quite busy. You can imagine how these things go. That's why I wanted to tune in very briefly and say, sorry for the slight drop. We think it's very listenable. So we hope you get lots of value from this. I know it's full of nuggets. So with that, apologies for the slight drop of what you might expect. And we hope that you get lots and lots from this conversation between me and Dr. Yelena Pavlovic. So without further ado, please enjoy. Dr. Yelena Pavlovic, welcome to the podcast. It's such an honor to have you.
Thank you, Yannick. Really privileged to be here with you and happy also. Looking forward to see where this conversation goes.
Yes, indeed. Me too. We're opening a new chapter. This is a new season of Coaching Uncaged, and we've decided to really explore and dig into the underlying frameworks and perspectives that coaches stand on. And you're a big name in constructivist coaching.
Thank you for that.
Yes, I mean you've published an excellent book on the subject. It really goes into a lot of areas of it. You're in Serbia, in Belgrade, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so you're doing a lot in the coaching world, and I would love to explore a little bit of where you're coming from. I'm not going to read your bio. I think it's helpful to know where you're speaking from, but I think that will also come out in the conversation. So I'm just really curious to dig into the constructivist framework. And I think what happens a lot, or it certainly happens to me, is my mind always wants to go to social constructivism when this is actually different. And I would love to start with laying out the framework for what is that framework? You know, what pillars does it stand on? What people's work does it stand on? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your story through the perspective of this lens, how you got into coaching with it.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you for the question. Nowadays, people are not so interested, I think, in frameworks rather than tools, you know, like, and what can we do quick and easy, like give me a tool, a technique, and so on. So back to frameworks sounds like an exciting question. So thank you for making this opportunity, Yannick. I don't know, nowadays when you say constructivism, constructivist psychology, it means very different things to different people. So that's the first kind of thing. So basically, we do have some streams, yes. So there is this stream, social constructivism, there is personal construct psychology, there is radical constructivism, there is social constructionism, which is not the same as social constructivism. And then, you know, it goes quite complicated. But I would say that there are some connecting dots between all of these. First of all, there is this belief that there is not one privileged perspective. And I would say that is the cornerstone of any kind of constructivism. Not one privileged perspective.
That is the one perspective.
Uh-huh. So in general, the idea that there are many perspectives is, I think, a foundational thing to constructivism. So that's how it all started, I guess, with interest into different perspectives that people hold. And you can trace that in psychology, let's say, from John Dewey, who was about how pupils learn, what were their implicit theories, not what is the formal theory of school, but rather how students actually come to receive or interact with those formal theories and what comes in their minds as implicit theory. So we're talking the beginning of 20th century, for example. Then Lev Vygotsky also with his ideas about how kids learn and also how we as a species evolve through interactions with other people and through tools that we create. That's also a very basic constructivist idea. And then I guess one name to mention, which actually had a great impact into the way I work and think, I guess, nowadays as a professional, but also as a person, is also George Kelly, who formulated personal construct psychology in the USA some 1950s, let's say, years after the Second World War, who actually made the clinical psychology framework out of constructivist ideas. And maybe that was the first attempt, actually, to put those ideas into a framework of clinical psychology. So we had some people who were thinking about constructivism in developmental psychology, basically, most, and also educational, maybe. But this was like the first time to think about how to use these ideas in clinical psychology. And it was a little bit...
So yeah, can I jump in there? Is there a core idea that that connects, or that all of these different constructivist and constructionist ideas have in common?
Yeah, sure. I guess there are a couple of those. One is no one truth, not one perspective, not one privileged point of view that we can stick to. That is, I guess, the first one.
So there isn't a truth as such. It's not that you can figure out psychology and then, you know, you've got it. But actually, yes, there's different perspectives, and they depend on the individual and the context.
Yeah, and I guess it's a radical idea, this one, for clinical psychology, because especially at the time when it got formulated, let's say some mid-20th century, we still had a kind of a clinical psychology landscape that was a little bit influenced by, you know, psychoanalysis, authorities. There is the analyst who obviously knows the truth. Even nowadays, it's hard for clinical people to say, okay, we're not the ones who know what's going on with our clients. That's a tricky position, even nowadays, so many years after all these ideas and theories that were formulated. So the idea of truth as, you know, like relative, let's use it that way, that's, I guess, the key to constructivism. But there are more. There's also the idea that these perspectives, or the way we think, the way we feel, the way we become as human beings, is actually forged in human interaction. So not so much, or to some extent, obviously, determined by biology, genetics, and so on. But at some point, it's also important how we interact with others, how we internalize other people's voices, the way others speak to us, that becomes our internal speech, and so on. So I already mentioned Vygotsky and the idea of social tools that become actually some sort of a vehicle to human development, and not only cognitive human development, but also something that we're more interested in perhaps here, and that is like lifespan development of people. So that's maybe the second one, like truth is relative, what we are becomes forged in social interactions. What else maybe to mention at this point? We always contribute, I guess. It's not the same as the first one, but the truth is relative. But we always contribute to what becomes known as truth. And that's, I guess, something applicable and visible maybe also, I don't know, in media and, I don't know, our worldviews that we create, but also in one-on-one psychotherapy sessions when we, as a therapist or a coach, also contribute to what becomes narrative that's being exchanged. So maybe just to settle with those three principles that connect.
So people really create themselves, and there isn't a dominant perspective on it. There isn't one thing to do it right. So how does that then influence coaching? I wonder how that, I mean, I know it's a big question, but like you might focus on a particular strand of this, but I wonder how it influences your coaching and how it shows up in the coaching group.
Great question. These ideas started, as I said, educational psychology, developmental, and big clinical, huge clinical psychological framework in the 50s. And then when 1990s started and the whole idea with the International Coaching Federation and so on, we got a little bit atheoretical. ICF is not connecting or attaching to one specific theory, but rather accrediting a variety of providers from different frameworks. But how ICF actually forged the ICF core competencies was, let's interview key people who were acting as coaches and let's see what they do. And fortunately, if you ask me, out of that empirical approach to developing competencies, we actually got a lot of constructivist ideas infused into ICF core competencies. So if you ask me again, this is quite a personal opinion, the way ICF nowadays prescribes, let's say, what it means to be a coach is very much constructivist. So partnering, the whole idea about partnering is so much a constructivist idea, because it means you are not the authority that, you know, like determines what goes on in a coaching session. You're not the one who knows better. You're not the one who knows first. And those ideas are actually so much connected to constructivist psychology. So coaching and constructivist psychology are really so much connected, fortunately, nowadays. Thanks to ICF.
Yeah, and it seems like common sense to people who get into coaching now. They're like, yes, of course, you trust the client to tap into their own resources, and they're the best expert on who they are. But it actually wasn't that common, especially in the contrast of the times, you know, where clinical psychologists and therapists and analysts were usually the ones that kind of knew better than the client. So it really sits at the core of what coaching is.
Exactly. Yes. I would say that really nowadays coaching, no matter how we call a perspective in coaching, it just got infused into constructivist ideas. And constructivism nowadays, I think, is so much a cornerstone of coaching, no matter whether we acknowledge that or not. Sometimes my colleagues who are into clinical psychology and so on are become a little bit puzzled, like, wow, coaches are constructivists. Well, clinical psychologists are still not. That's an interesting fact. Clinical psychologists working in institutions still maybe are operated by some other mental models, where authority and expert knowledge is more important than implicit, tacit knowledge of people that we work with. But coaching, for some reason, went the other way. So that's a nice thing, if you ask me.
Yeah. So why do you think that constructivist roots of coaching aren't really that commonly acknowledged?
I don't know. One reason maybe is that ICF is largely theoretical. So ICF does not promote any kind of school. So I guess it would be unfair to say we promote constructivism. That's not really the case. And I don't think it's so much actually important to, you know, like to say, like, I don't know, imagine the scenario where some ICF official goes out and in some sort of a podcast says, ICF framework is constructivism. That won't happen, I think, anytime ever. But it's not
important. Well, it just
happened. I'm definitely not an ICF official. So it's not important, maybe, you know, like to brand things. It's branding, it's attaching labels. Let's do coaching the way it's most beneficial for our clients and call it whatever you like. That's my kind of approach. So I guess, you know, like as a regulatory body, ICF just didn't have any kind of interest or even had a conflict of interest to promote one specific approach. So that's not really like so important.
Yeah, that makes sense. How interesting. I'm a fan of not applying labels and just, you know, calling it whatever you need to call it in order to let the client do good work.
That's the only like driving thing that we have in coaching and also in all kind of helping professions. Let's not stick to, you know, like labels or some sort of school that we start to treat like some doctrines or ideologies even, but rather let's stay pragmatic and see how to adapt best to people that we work with.
Yeah. So how come you made the decision that you're going to put that framework out there for the context of coaching? I mean, they're already quite aligned, but I guess you could have just done the work, but you decided to not label it, but like pay some homage and some tribute and pay some respect to the underlying framework that is there. Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, well, my one part of my profession or professional identity is academic. I'm also in business and in consultancy and so on, but I started my profession, my career actually as an academic, and still I'm an academic, I guess.
Never quite leaves us, does it?
There is this kind of almost a need to put things out, you know, And since that was like something that was really like a mental model for me, and it still is, what I mean is actually constructivist ideas drive me in profession as key ideas. And also maybe in my personal life, like with interacting with my kids or with my husband and so on, it's like, I don't know, something that's really got under my skin very early on, because I got exposed to those ideas even during the university years. And after the university, I pursued some clinical training, constructivism and so on. So that was really like, you know, like a mental model that is the dominant one. You know, like it's a little bit paradoxical, like there are no dominant frameworks, but actually that framework dominated me. And at some point, I guess it was 3 or 4 years ago, it was just like, okay, these kinds of ideas are knocking to get out of my head. You know, but I guess it would also be very, I don't know, respectful of many colleagues that I had the luck to meet during my career, and to say that many of those tools and ideas actually were already there, made by a variety of people that I quoted, of course, in the book. But it was just like applying them in one specific context, taking them out of clinical context and modifying their use for the coaching purpose. So that's what I did. At that point, it didn't sound as like, you know, something huge, creating a framework. I didn't create a framework, but rather made a collage of different ideas and how they could apply to the coaching context.
Yeah, I'd love to explore that a little bit more. I mean, we've been kind of laying the landscape of it. I am super curious about the practicalities of it. Is there even a typical constructivist coaching kind of story that you could tell us? Or, I mean, it differs from client to client, but I wonder how we could imagine a constructivist coach working. I mean, partly it's just good coaching. Right. But maybe you could tell us a story about how you've worked with a client where that illustrates what makes this constructivist.
Yeah, I guess I see in a way disciplines coaches nowadays to be constructivist people, even they don't recognize it, obviously. So what I see promotes as a model of coaching nowadays and what is constructivist coaching is quite similar. So I guess there wouldn't be many surprises in any story that I would now perhaps tell or share. Like, that's usual coaching. Maybe some, let's say, add-ons to that are creativity. I see this talking about creativity to some extent. To some extent. In the definition of coaching, you have the word creative process and so on. And in the core competencies, we also have here and there, a little bit of coaching clients create something new, a new perspective, a new way of thinking, and so on. But creativity is there like implicitly. In constructivism, creativity is all, really. An authentic encounter, and I know that this sounds maybe like humanistic psychology, and to some extent, humanistic psychology and constructivist psychology share quite a lot. So authentic encounter where people get creative about the way they think. That's maybe something that is another layer to what ICF just promotes as good coaching. In practice, that may mean that, you know, like you're stuck with a client. You don't know what to say. You don't know what to do. You've tried a couple of things. And ICF would actually encourage coaches maybe to give some feedback and share some of that, like, you know, your kind of perception of the process. We would treat that as ethical thing from a coach. But maybe constructivist people would also, I don't know, get some other resources internally, like a metaphor, or I don't know, use something that is to their own creativity, maybe specific, like some people like to sing, some people like to draw, whatever. Like use different tools, different symbolic systems to actually connect with the client and to share what's going on in the moment. And also to spark that same process on the other side, in the other person. Like to connect not only to express your creativity, but rather to try to see what works with the person's creativity. When I say creativity, not really like expressive arts, not really like necessarily drawing, dancing, singing, or whatever, acting, but rather creative thinking, thinking beyond our usual patterns, beyond our schemes, routines, patterns in which we are stuck. That like window in a session when we open up to people, okay, just leave your pattern, your good old pattern, leave it on the table. It will be there, don't worry, like, you know.
Easier said than done.
Yes, it's not like you're leaving it forever, because people will never leave it, obviously. But, you know, like, we manage resistance by saying your pattern of thinking will be still there, even if you abandon it for a couple of minutes. It's so, you know, like, comforting for people.
So kind of like when somebody is going to an acting class or a singing class and they just leave their ego at the door and they just give themselves permission to, you know, be someone different.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely has a lot to do with that. But in those seconds, we actually are making the other person creative. Like, we are allowing expression that goes beyond usual sense of who people are. It's sometimes scary. It's sometimes very hard. But I don't know, constructivist training gives us some sort of an idea that it's a must in a session. Not maybe in every session, not maybe with every client, but in general, that we should be accustomed to the idea that that's where we are going. We are not settling for much less, but rather to those creative moments when people say, this is who I am, but let me try out who else I can be. And that is really like constructivist add-on, I guess, to ICF.
Yeah, I love that. So how do you find your way in that? Because it sounds like when you say creative, it's a lot more deep. Like, it means a lot more than if you just pick it up from an ICF competency. Yeah. Or yes, this is a creative endeavor, but creativity is something that is easily said. And I think it's more challenging to actually invite clients into that space. What are some ways in which you access that kind of creativity? I mean, you mentioned dancing, singing. I mean, I haven't had someone dancing or singing in a coaching session. Drawing, yes, absolutely. But it seems that there's a very playful way to work with people here. So I wonder if you could give us a flavor of some of the ways in which you can access that kind of creativity in the coaching.
Yeah. I guess some preparation is key there, like making sure that people feel safe. That's the first thing, like, you know, they wouldn't be judged, they wouldn't be wouldn't have the opportunity to feel ashamed in a session with you or anything like that. So safety really comes first. After that, maybe some sort of encouragement to be brave and at the same time, you know, like, vulnerable, like both at the same time, like exposing yourself. Obviously, whenever we say, okay, try to, I don't know, in some imaginary session, try to say something in a different way than you would usually say to somebody at work, for example. It's, you know, like a moment of vulnerability for everybody, because they're, you know, like trying out something for the first time. You don't know what would be the reception. Maybe they would be funny. Maybe the coach would laugh. But, you know, like, very different things may go through their mind. So safety first, some sort of encouragement to be brave, but also to be vulnerable and to just, you know, like, accept any kind of outcome as an experiment. In his theory, personal construct psychology, George Kelly treated people as personal scientists who actually carry out experiments that create change. I guess that kind of mindset also helps a lot in coaching. You know, like, make an experiment, see what goes on. If it fails, well, you just tried. Let's stay curious about where this experiment leads us. Even adopting experimental language helps a little bit. It's not maybe what ICF, again, instructs us to do, but just using that language, let's try out, let's see what happens. That's actually talking about some small experiments implicitly. So that helps. Safety, encouragement, being brave, being vulnerable, and treating everything that happens as really some sort of an experiment. Not really a creative play, but rather scientific experiment that is equally exciting as creative play.
Yeah, I remember this so well from when I talked to Kim Bradley Cole, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes,
that she really highlighted George Kelly's, well, this is an experiment, we're scientists. And I mean, we're both academics, so I guess it gels quite well. I wonder how you apply that with coaching clients who might not be so scientifically minded and might not have a history or background in science. They might not actually understand science. How do you work with someone like that? How do you open up that kind of perspective? Or do people already come in who resonate with that kind of scientific mindset?
Yes, it would be very demanding to expect every person that we work with to, you know, have a scientific background. I'm not sure it would be productive anyway, because, you know, like being disciplined in some sort of academic thinking is not the same as being flexible to try out new things. It can be, but it doesn't go together necessarily. So it's basically some sort of a very common, very usual language that we're using. We're not using the words like, this is a hypothesis. Ah, interesting. Let's test another hypothesis. That's, you know, like too demanding. Saying, let's try this out. Let's see what goes out of it. Let's try out something else. Yes. Let's compare this and that. You know, that you, intuitively using the model rather than expecting our clients to know the theory. That would be so demanding.
Yeah, and I think that's so helpful because I think everybody's a scientist at heart. I mean, I have a little daughter, so I can see her experiments. You know, she's not doing 3x3 ANOVAs. You know, she's not doing any kind of research methodologies, but she's experimenting all the time. Oh, what happens if I throw this glass off the table? Oh, wow, my parents get a bit dismayed. You know, there's a good outcome because now you've learned something, even though the outcome might not be preferable for the parents who need to clean up the mess. But I think everybody's got a scientist in them. So in order to tap into this with quite natural language and not the academic or scientific language that can be a bit repulsive to people, I think everybody's got a scientist in them. And it's so helpful to encourage that scientist to come out again and do some experimentation.
Yeah, definitely. And there's so much creativity in it, actually, back to creativity. That kind of stepping out and being a scientist, as you say, it is a little bit of a creative act. Not so much discipline, cognitive, you know, like act where you follow some routine, some strict or principles of thinking and so on. There is a little bit of that, but maybe coach does more than the client maybe regarding some bits and pieces of that. But rather just like, you know, saying, okay, my behavior is one way of doing things. There is the other way. There are many other ways. Let's try some of those other ways and see how they work for myself and for other people in the world. That's so experimental and scientific and creative at the same time. And brave also. Whenever our clients do that or try to do that, are on the edge of doing that kind of things, I think we should congratulate for a hugely brave thing they did. You know, like it's not a small step to leave your, you know, like skin and your usual way of thinking and say, okay, I'll experiment with something else. It's brave. It takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, leaving unfamiliar shores and leaving the safe haven and really going and growing. I mean, anybody with a desire to grow is putting courage out there, unless it's coming from a place where they really cannot stand what is right now anymore and they have to move on. So I wonder, it sounds like this could be quite a structured approach in terms of, well, you sit down with someone, you kind of tap into their inner scientist. Does it go along with homework? Does it go along with exercises, with kind of reviewing what they have done? Or how does it work in practice?
Not necessarily. I'm not a big fan of homeworks or some sort of exercises between the sessions. Like more like, you know, my favorite kind of way to leave the session with a client is to inspire rather than structure an activity. You know, if somebody says, I could be more present in a meeting, I wouldn't go into details, okay, describe when, what meeting, when will you do that, by what time, you know, like we have a lot of project management thinking, a way of thinking in, I don't know, in working lives, definitely, in organizations. So in a coaching session, adding more project management is for me like, people don't like that really. And I'm not a fan or a believer that it really works. But if we say, just try to be more present, let's maybe just see and understand together what it means to you. Are there any risks? Is there anything that maybe sparks you to try it out? Any sort of benefit that you see in it and so on? And, you know, like leaving it half cooked, like not really a homework, not really an exercise, not really a project to manage, but rather an idea to test whenever, with whomever, if possible. That's the kind of a space that I feel more comfortable with, you know, like without pressure, without managing a project, but rather with sparking creativity if possible. If not, we'll think of something else. I don't know.
Right, so it's more the kind of scientist that we tap into that really wants to figure out the answer to something, and not the kind of scientist that is within an institution with deadlines for publication and they need to record every step of the way.
Yes, great way to put it. Thank you for making this kind of addition. I think a great way to put that in it. Yes.
Yeah, because I sometimes find myself envious of people like Tim Ferriss, for example. He has all of these notebooks and he's such a natural scientist. He's just like trying things out, recording all the data, and then looking back at what was the most optimal way. And I think when many people hear scientists, they think of this mad person in the lab with all of these spreadsheets and, you know, all of these data output files. But that's not really the kind of scientist that we're tapping into. We're tapping into people's natural curiosity about how they work and building themselves up with experimenting and seeing what it's like to try on a different construct.
Yeah. And if you ask me, it shouldn't be hard on people to force those experiments, to force, like, you have to do this. You need to change that. You need to try this out. You need to do that by Monday, by next session, and so on. I think it doesn't help. I think what helps more is, and it's sometimes more challenging actually, to tap into their own like space where they say, yes, this is good for me, and yes, I want to do this. Like some sort of accountability rather than external pressure. I don't think that external pressure works in coaching.
Yeah, yeah. It needs to come from within, that motivation, inspiration, rather than pressure.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. It kind of points to a deeper question there, psychologically, in terms of, well, when people hear construct and they hear, well, leave that pattern at the door, leave who you are at the door, try out something new, try on a different set of clothes in a way, a different set of behaviors. There's this idea of fake it till you make it, that if you just behave in a certain way, then you become that person. Other schools of psychology argue that there's something that is very core, that's you, and that doesn't really change. So I wonder what's the constructivist view or perspective on that change? Is that even possible? It seems quite playful that you can try on new things, and when you try them on, part of you becomes that person. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess it's a lot of ideas that you just mentioned that were like, you know, making some connections in my head while listening to you. One of those is Kelly, the founder of this personal construct psychology, actually was quite influenced by Moreno and psychodrama approach of the 20th century. So that kind of try it out, you know, like fake it until you make it a play, act it out. That was part of, you know, like, constructivist framework, definitely. Even in, let's say, cognitive behavioral therapy or CB coaching nowadays, you also have that behavioral rehearsal. It's not really like psychodrama or anything like that, but it is like, you know, like act like you're whatever, or maybe more behaviorally than in constructivism, not like you're a different kind of, you know, a person with different kind of a mindset, but rather maybe behaviorally more narrow, or at least that is my perception of it. But we have that kind of fake it till you make it, I think, ever since Moreno. And it got infused into nowadays schools of thinking, I think, so much, also in constructivism. I wouldn't say it's really like fake it until you make it, although I know that some of my colleagues who are constructivism use that, but it doesn't really resonate so much with me, that kind of a wording, let's say. It's more like, I don't know, you're not stretching me to think, to find words for
good.
What I'm thinking here. Nobody asked me, is it about fake it until you make it? So I need to, you know, like, tap into my own kind of words for this to explain. It's more like see what else is there, you know, like not fake would be don't believe in that, it's not you. Just using the word fake it would mean actually you know who you are, and now fake something else, act like something else. Here it's more like explore what else. It's not faking, it's more like exploring. So I wouldn't say faking. Although there is, like, sometimes even try to do things that are hard for you, That's maybe the faking part, and see what comes out of it until you make it. So maybe just, you know, like that kind of change is not always easy. So using that wording, fake it until you make it, sometimes is comforting actually, because people say, okay, this is a process and I don't need to feel this authentically 100% to be able to change at some point. So it can be helpful, although it's not something that resonates with me personally so much.
Yeah. I love that that just happened, because I really don't like fake it till you make it either. Because I think it's quite a facetious way to make something sound kind of negative, because faking it, people have quite negative associations with it, especially in an age where authenticity and integrity is really valued very highly. I think when you start wearing different clothes, for example, something that you might not feel is entirely you, you wear it and then maybe you grow into it. I've had that with a couple of things that my mom gave me for Christmas, and I'm like, oh, I don't know. But she actually knows me better than I thought. Because with quite a few of those garments, I've been like, I don't, that's not me. And because it was there, and maybe I hadn't washed in a while, and then I was wearing it. And as I was wearing it, I'm like, oh, maybe it's much more me than I had appreciated. So it's not that I was faking it, wearing a different sweater that doesn't feel entirely me, but it's an experiment. Right. And I think that kind of experiment is really helpful. And I think it's great that you were looking for more positive words, because yes, that idea is there, but it's not represented well by how that's being worded. So I'd also encourage clients to try on something that maybe doesn't feel entirely like them. And I think that's the really courageous part, especially for people who value authenticity highly, to do something or show up in a way that doesn't feel entirely like them, because maybe it's unfamiliar. Maybe you're developing a new way of being. And I think people who are in transition, that comes quite naturally. But I think anybody can initiate a transition by experimenting more with wearing new constructs. And I think that clothing metaphor probably works quite well.
Yeah, the clothing metaphor is definitely beautiful. One personal maybe story here. Nowadays, whenever I catch myself, not my clients, but myself, saying, this isn't me, I feel so happy. There's something that I have to explore, you know, like at the moment I think like, this is not me, you know, in some even negative sense, like, that's not me. But I just pause and, you know, like say, okay, but that means that maybe I can experiment a little bit there, because whenever you say that's not me, you're actually entering some wall, recognizing the wall and saying, okay, but there is something maybe beyond that wall that needs exploring. And you can always come back and say, well, I didn't like that.
I think this is such an important point. I want to celebrate it and underline it, because I think a lot of coaching clients, and I think a lot of coaches as well, they shy away from everything that doesn't feel fully authentic, right? Choose the path of least resistance. Just be yourself. And yourself is just an ever-evolving concept. And I think social constructivists have opened up that we can actually play a very creative and playful role in shaping who we are, rather than there's this expectation that we need to figure out who we are and it's this one thing and then we need to stick to this. And we can only be authentic when we are aligned with what we already know about ourselves. But I think social constructivism and social constructionist approaches as well, they just open up a lot more freedom to become a different person by trying on some new things. So I have that with coaches in terms of marketing all the time, being visible. Oh, I'm not the person who's visible. I'm not the person who reaches out to people. I'm not the person who contacts someone they would like to work with and make a proposal. Oh, this feels very salesy, or this feels very pushy. And I know me now compared to me 10 years ago, I say things in consultations that I, 10 years younger Yannick would have been like, what? what are you doing? And now it feels authentic and it feels good. It feels valuable. I'm like, of course I would say that, because we are evolving. And I think a lot of people wait to evolve. And I think what you're inviting your clients to do is take an active part. And where do you want that evolution to move towards?
Yeah, Yeah, beautifully put into words. So thank you, Yannick. Yes, definitely. Humanistic psychology made a huge contribution with the idea of authenticity. Constructivist psychology just turned that authenticity and said, okay, there is not one authenticity. There are many authenticities. You can play with them and explore what kind of different things make you feel authentic. So that's like, it's not like shutting down authenticity, but rather saying it's not one thing, but it can be diverse area of things that make you feel authentic. And I think that helps, actually. Yeah. Helps coaches and persons also.
Oh yeah, so many people say, oh, just be yourself, you know, show up to work fully authentic. I'm not sure if that's a good idea. You know, I think there's a professional self, and I think parts of your personal construct in terms of parts of your personality that you are at home or with your friends in the pub, maybe leave that at home. Maybe don't bring that to work, you know? So there's a difference. You can still be very authentic, even though your mates from the pub would look at you thinking, well, who is that person? You know, it can still feel very authentic. So I love that idea of there isn't one authenticity, there's many.
Yeah, definitely.
What else?
But where else would you like this conversation to lead? So there are many, I feel like this is like a constructivist coach would now say, there are so many paths. Where would you like us to go next?
Exactly. That's why I'm throwing a very vague coaching question in there and see if you take it somewhere.
Yeah. Well, let me think maybe what comes like the next thing to explore here. I don't know. Like we made some, maybe there's some sort of a story like where constructivism goes next, or what's the next kind of stop, where does it evolve? That's maybe something that's interesting to me, and also an area in which I didn't maybe think too much, so it's like interesting for me to exchange ideas with you. So it's a little bit like a selfie direction. But
I love it. I love it. That's also part of what we want to do here. We want to kind of lay out the basics of it and the foundations and look at in practice how does it show up, but also where is it going. So, I mean, this is quite an old, it's been around for some time, right? Could you talk us through how it's been evolving before maybe we look at where's next and what kind of directions is it evolving now?
So maybe the roots, if we don't go into ancient Rome or something like that, but rather stick to some beginnings of scientific thinking, let's say in psychology or education and so on. John Dewey with idea that learners are also in a way personal scientists or create some personal theories about their learning, and that we as teachers need to connect to their personal theories. That is maybe the first kind of really like constructivist idea in practice, in educational practice. The one person that I don't skip, I guess, is also Lav Vygotsky with this idea. Whenever you talk to your child or with your family members, with your friends, with your colleagues, with other human beings in general, you're actually contributing to some extent to how they start talking to themselves, because social exchange becomes internalized. The tools that we create as a human species become tools for human development. So that is the kind of, I don't know, early beginnings. And then we had the huge framework. And when I say huge framework, it really is huge. It's 2,000 pages of George Kelly's book on personal construct psychology, how we can actually expand all those ideas into a coherent and, let's say, logical framework of working with basically clinical clients. So that's a huge milestone, I guess, in the evolution of coaching. Jean Piaget also, with his ideas about human development, maybe also another person to mention, some people that were thinking systemically at the 70s, like Gregory Bateson and the other people around him, definitely contributed also to this kind of systemic view of that we are not like, you know, like units, individual units who just make those experiments for themselves, but rather we are hyper-connected, and that resonates nowadays even more than in the 70s, I guess, that kind of idea of the system. And maybe in the 80s, somewhere in the 80s, we had educational psychology exploding with constructivism. So many people, especially in the States, started actually talking about constructivist idea. And that's when the social constructivism was maybe forged as the wording. We started talking about scaffolding children at schools, about the importance of interaction, the, again, communicational patterns that we share with kids in schools and so on. So educational psychology in the 80s, I guess, was really like so much inspired by constructivist psychology. In the 90s, ICF was formed, and well, that's kind of huge part of history. As I said, a little bit theoretical, but basically, luckily, based on empirical data, we made ICF so much constructivist nowadays. I hope nobody will quote this, like, for ICF, and I will get again contacted by ICF and say, oh, where did you get that? I would say it's just my kind of thing. So that was an important milestone. ICF and that kind of grounding the competencies in empirical data about what works. And ever since the 2000s, this is, again, my personal opinion, and maybe some of my colleagues wouldn't so much agree, we had some phase that I would call, you know, like utilization of constructivism. I wouldn't say that many new things came out. It was more like applying constructivist ideas systematically across different sectors, contexts, and so on. And that's where also my kind of contribution with the book comes in. I didn't think anything new, I think, but just, you know, like made a compilation of what could work in a specific context. And we were like swimming in that for 20 years, maybe, that we are actually exploiting constructivism, utilizing it rather than creating and recreating. So that's maybe an interesting point in which we are now. And I would even dare and say that nowadays we are much more constructivist. And when I say we, I think across the globe, media, all kinds of discourses that are so dominant. This is like we are living in a constructivist era. And they wouldn't say that's necessarily a very good thing, because, of course, being a constructivist psychologist, I would say, constructivism is almost everywhere nowadays. But I'm coming into situations when I say, oh, this is so much constructivist that me as a constructivist person would say, no, I'm not more of this, and so on. So maybe we are on some sort of a, I don't know, turning point, maybe, when something different will also come. Hopefully not something that would be an ideology and some sort of a return to one truth. I wouldn't be happy to see that. But maybe that's actually coming across the horizon, some sort of like, you know, all ideas in the end tear out, you know, like that's history of ideas. So maybe we are approaching that moment when it would just be so much used and utilized that we need something new and fresh. But again, this is really like thinking fresh here with Yannick, not something that I think quite often about.
Yeah, good. I really like it, right? Because I think in the world, I agree, right? I'm really happy that you laid all of this out. And my God, there's so much knowledge sprouting out of you. It's amazing, just in terms of quick rerun of the history through the decades. But I think we are living in times where a lot of people would like to be more grounded in one truth. And I see part of the divide socially. I see a lot of people craving simple truths. And I mean, I'm a big believer in life's complexity and us being ever evolving. But I also understand the need to ground ourselves in one construct, in one truth about who we are. People really crave to be certain quite naturally, and yet it's really difficult to have any certainty. So what I'm picking up from you is that we can go too far with instilling this idea of I can be whoever I like, I can build a personal construct, I can experiment, I can try on new things, and I can become different people in the process, and I can steer that. But if it becomes too malleable, if it becomes too free, too open, Kierkegaard talks about the dizziness of freedom, right? If we have the freedom to be whoever we like, and we just need to put the work in, and we can shape and construct ourselves, that can help have people lose their footing and their grounding. And I see that in coaching as well. For coaches, one of the biggest questions that I see in the supervision room is, who am I? right? Who you are is how you coach. What kind of coach are you? People want you to niche. You know, social constructivism is a wonderful thing to ground yourself in. I found mine in existentialism and positive psychology, right? But I think there's a lot of coaches out there who ask themselves, well, who am I? Who the hell am I? I don't know. I don't know what kind of coach I am. Now I'm supposed to pick this combination of words that is somehow instilling certainty and confidence and clarity in my clients about what kind of practitioner I am. So I think we can take it too far in terms of personal freedom. And I think people are craving more clarity and more grounding. So I think it's really difficult to strike that kind of balance.
Yeah. Take just the popular psychology books. In majority of them, you would have somewhere a message or even a clear sentence that says, you can be whoever you want. Just believe in it and you can be whoever you want. It's become the way we start to think about ourselves, you know, and it's like even a pressure we put on ourselves that we need to change so much, you know, and that change is like, you know, like the universal criteria of health. And to some extent it is, but if we overuse these ideas, we just may come into that kind of terror of constructivism. Hopefully we wouldn't be there. Like everybody needs to change much more than, you know, like we would like to feel comfortable or internally just have the need to change so much. So I guess popular psychology is so much dominated by this idea of change that comes easy and quickly. You know, you just do this and you will change. It doesn't go really well.
Instant transformation.
Yes.
Just work with a coach for 6 sessions.
Yes, I'm really not a big fan of that. So that's kind of overuse of coaching. And obviously there can also of constructivism, not of coaching. And there can obviously be some abuse, not overuse, but just like abuse of constructivist ideas also. Like, again, whenever we force ideas on people, no matter whether we call them constructivists or not, we're in a way like abusing ideas. So that's the kind of, again, thing that I wouldn't like to see in future so much, like forcing constructivism is more in a way abusing it in any way, but hopefully that wouldn't come.
So where's the boundary then, or where's the limit to how much we can change according to constructivist theory? It like, because you could say, well, half of who we are is genetics. You could say we're completely blank slate and we can, you know, become whoever we'd like to be if we just follow up with the right kind of behavior and we do the work, right? Some schools of psychology say, well, we're relatively fixed because we are so formed by our primary caregivers and how we've grown up that early years development is just, we cannot take that apart anymore. We cannot untangle that. So where's the limit to how much we can change?
As an academic, I wouldn't maybe answer this question from the constructivist point of view, because it doesn't really give some clear cut answers. I maybe will share some of those. But what works for me when I get confronted with that kind of a question is more like psychometric data. So we have some psychometric data, let's say Brent Roberts from the University of Illinois, who is recording in longitudinal studies change across different traits, personality traits that do change. So we have psychometric data that demonstrate that change in personality tests that are actually very fixed, or even we could say they are fixing personality because you're more fixed in a personality test maybe than in your real life. So it's really like a tool that fixes, and it's built to fix in a way your personality and your nature. But even in that kind of assessments, we record change, especially over the years, then it's in a way, you know, like encouraging that some extent of change is possible. These data aren't like popular psychology books, like saying, just imagine and you will wake up as a different person. It's not like that. They're pointing to modest changes over some of the traits, especially they're pointing to formative impact of work, for example. Also to just growing up, like in adulthood and in early age, people just change spontaneously also. So sort of, you know, just growing up also changes us. work context also changes. So these data are pointing to some formative experiences, which are not normal life experiences or not normal work experiences, that still manage to record change over time in personality tests. That's really interesting to me and something that's, you know, like encouraging, because it's not like overwhelming and saying, ah, change is everywhere, you can manage whatever you want in your life, but rather like some sort of modest, I would say, modest, optimistic position that we can change even on extroversion, introversion, and that kind of things, social dominance and so on. But it takes time and we don't change into extreme.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that introversion, extroversion scale, because again, a lot of coaches feel they should probably be more extrovert, or they should, but it would help their business if they were more extrovert. There's ways in which an introvert coach can do marketing in their own way, but especially when we think about marketing, connecting with people, coaching usually works through building relationships, and extroverts find it a lot easier to build relationships because they're naturally find energy, or they recharge their batteries by going out and connecting to people. So I know there's a lot of introvert coaches out there who would love to be more extrovert. If you had someone like that in your coaching room, whether that's a coach or not, but somebody who would like to be more extrovert, how would you tackle that?
Yes, I guess that's the kind of the type of client that I had, or I never had a client who is too extrovert and wants to be a little bit more introvert. That doesn't happen, but this
society yeah. favors the extroverts.
Yes, definitely. I don't know, you know, like any kind of a topic, explore a little bit why it's important, what is working now, what are the things that this person would like to change, like what's introversion giving you that you're grateful for? And that's like a paradoxical question. We never ask why we want to stay the same. I really like to ask that question in a coaching session. Like, why would you like to stay the same?
Yeah, well, how does it serving you? Great question.
Yes. And also, what would you benefit from change? What would extroversion bring you and so on? And then try to find, there are tools also for that, like ABC tool that I explored in the book. I didn't create that tool, just took it from one of the colleagues from the constructivist community, quoting, of course, in the book. So it's like making sure that what a person gains from current state and from the change state is in a way balanced. Like not become an extreme extrovert, and psychometric data says you cannot anyway, and just abandon everything that's good and working for you as an introvert, but rather, how can you combine what you already have and a little bit of extroversion so it works for you better? Mm-hmm. And that's that kind of, you know, both and, not like abandon introversion, become an extreme extrovert, but rather build on who you are into something that's new to you and create a blend that's really practical for you. So that would be the kind of, you know, leading the conversation through some of those questions.
Yeah, so slowly expanding your concept of self rather than radically changing it. And yes. I think that's part of the discourse in some areas of coaching, this huge transformation that you mentioned earlier, right? This pressure to transform radically, where actually step by step, integrating new ways of being, looking at different contexts in which you could show up differently, you know, wear that extrovert sweater, maybe to an event where it feels relatively safe, maybe first try it out within the coaching room, you know, and then creating psychological safety and trying out more and experimenting more and then see what sticks.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question just to continue the line of thinking? If you were more of an extrovert, what color of your sweater would be now in this podcast, Jan?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it definitely shows part of my work that I've done around showing up more extrovertly.
Yes. Because if you ask me, it would be something yellow. So before the podcast, we just agreed that we were color matched. So my extroversion would go into yellow something, but definitely not present at the moment.
Oh, up until my late 20s, I reckon, I was mainly wearing gray, black, colorless clothes. And I think that said something around how I'd like to be in the world. You know, when I went to an event, I talked to one person the whole evening, you know, rather than connecting to everyone. I did find out that I have a strength of woo in the Gallup Strength Finder. And I'm like, no way. And I didn't recognize that in myself at all. So it was a very interesting way to find, to experiment with something, to just use a psychometric and realize, oh, actually, there is something that I thought shouldn't be there. But now that I'm reflecting on it a little bit more, it opened some doors. And there is actually an extrovert side of me. And I can lean into it in the context, in particular contexts, when I'm teaching, when I'm on a podcast, when I have a good reason to be somewhere, you know, under my subjective evaluation of what good reason constitutes, right? But I think we can open, that's how we open these things up. And when we talk to clients, then if they have a desire, we can explore that and we can help them make moves towards it. And I love that you're asking me about what would be the color, right? Because I can imagine that conversation in a coaching room. I've never accessed that kind of thinking through this kind of question.
Yeah. Next time, another podcast in yellow sweater. So let's see where that would lead.
I did buy a yellow polo shirt, and I have to wear something on top. It's too much if it's just completely yellow. So yeah, getting there. Yelena, sorry, go on.
Anything for the end? Just any kind of like a topic to end this conversation.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, right? What could tie this up nicely? Because we explored a lot. We explored where it's coming from. We explored kind of where it's going. We explored how it could be applied. Do you feel there's something that people don't often talk about, or some maybe a common misunderstanding, or just something you would want coaches to know?
Well, I don't know really. Like, just exploring the frameworks is a little bit like old school, not in a bad way, but rather in a good way, if you ask me. Like, we're not thinking so much about frameworks. We are much more into tools and techniques, I guess, nowadays. So thank you for the opportunity to come back to the frameworks, to some, as you said, history of the ideas and so on. I enjoyed it because it was really like a rare opportunity nowadays to have a conversation. So thank you, Jan, for setting up this conversation.
Well, that's what we want to do in this season, right? So I know Kim's book is full of tools and application areas. I know coaches love their tools and they love the application and they love to get as practical as possible. I think it's important we do that, build on a good foundation for what this is and why it is. But could you give some pointers to where people could go to find the many tools that come from that sector, or where people can explore a little bit more?
Yeah, so definitely there are so many books nowadays on constructivist ideas and application also. So one of the favorite books that I can recommend from this framework is definitely Peter Hawkins' books on systemic coaching, systemic team coaching, leadership team coaching, and again, with systemic ideas. So that's maybe something that's, I don't know, a book that I usually recommend. Like Peter is maybe more branded as systemic coach, but talking to Peter, he would agree. I know that he's also like systemic constructivist psychology. One of his teachers was Gregory Bateson. So definitely a lot of constructivism undermined. So one of those books definitely full of coaching tools. I think that's team coaching in practice, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. There are at least a couple of books that Peter wrote. Some of them are more like expanding on the theory, and some others are more into tools and cases. So that's definitely a thing to recommend.
Yeah, he was guest on his podcast as well, and he's so inspiring to listen to. So if people wanted to learn more about systemic, really interesting to see the link as well from personal construct to systemic constructs. And we cannot really take ourselves out of the systems that we're nested in. So I think it's really important to take that into account.
Yeah, definitely.
Lovely. Well, where could people follow more of your work? If people listening to this and they're like, oh, I really like what Yelena is saying, I love her approach. Where can people learn more, other than obviously a book on constructivist coaching?
Yes, there's a book. Occasionally, I also write academic papers. So that's one thing also to a Google Scholar. Like, you can always surf and see what's coming next. I'm also running a coaching center, a small consultancy here in Serbia. So there is also this website for that. We're running some ICF accredited programs. So that's also maybe something of interest. And that's basically that kind of a life of academic and practitioner. You know, you write a little bit, teach a little bit, and then apply also in the real world a little bit of that.
I very much resonate with that. So thank you for keeping a foot in academia, because I think it's important. And I think it's very tempting for coaches, once they get to a certain level of grounded success, to just do the work and, you know, spend less time in expanding the foundations. So I really appreciate that you continue to think about where this approach is going. And yeah, jam with me. That was very enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Yannick.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To watch these episodes on video, make sure you also check out youtube.com/animascoaching. See you back here soon.